Tom Gimbel joins us on another Tuesday. Hi, Tom. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, John Williams.
Tom's the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network. The LaSalleNetwork.com is the website. I know you're thinking about employees going back. We seem to have a conversation along those lines almost every week. What's the latest on that front, Tom?
So we're bringing people back for one day a week starting now. Then come Labor Day, we're doing 2 days a week. And then to begin the fourth quarter in October, we're going to do 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So we're going to ease people back in and then have a hybrid schedule of 3 days in and 2 days remote work.
Now, how did you come up with that? And why are you not just opening the door and saying 5 days a week, 8 to 5 like the old days?
Well, anybody can come in 5 days a week. So that's fundamental. We have a lot of people that do want to work 5 days a week in the office. And people also want the flexibility. And it's where the world is, and the expression "you can't fight City Hall" is an accurate one. And for this purpose, it makes sense to give people an opportunity. Now, we'll see where the economy goes and where the unemployment rate goes and how employees gravitate towards that. But, you know, it's what we're trying to do is create an environment where people who have proven themselves have the ability of flexibility. And where people who are new, either out of college or new to the company, can be around other people and onboard more quickly and have more training and development. And we figured that 60% in, 40% voluntary off or out of the office was a good compromise.
I wonder if you or businesses like yours will say some employees are more productive at home and some are more productive in the office. Some you need to watch or monitor more carefully, and they may not appreciate the distinction, but you're the boss, so you're not going to issue a blanket statement. You're going to case by case decide who has to be in the office how much. What do you think of that?
I think you're absolutely right that there are certain people who, due to their personality, good or bad, may be better at one place or the other, and how they interact with others and their ability to get things done and focus, that they may be better off at home. However, the productivity issue is going to be very unique, and it's going to be different than the past 15 months. The past 15 months that I think you and I, John, have spoken about was based on the ability to not leave the house for the most part. We couldn't go to ball games. We weren't meeting our friends for coffee or lunch or happy hours. All we were doing was working. And we'll know over the next 12 months from a productivity issue of how people can produce when they're not in the office environment, when they have a lot of distractions available. And we just can't judge that at this point. We have to wait and see where that is when we have a real sample size.
This is weird. Heather Sharon, a reporter at Channel 11, is a friend of ours, and she's on the Mincing Rascals podcast with me. Well, a couple months ago, she said that it was the first time that she had been in the physical presence of the other employees because she got hired during the pandemic. And so she was just in her living room working for a company where she didn't really know anybody. And it was kind of an interesting thing to then finally be in the presence of these folks. And I suppose a lot of companies that have hired folks during the pandemic are going through the same sort of situation.
There's no doubt about it, John. We've increased our workforce at my company, LaSalle Network, by 25% just this calendar year and over 32% going back to when the pandemic started. And so what we said was there's got to be some ways to ease people back in. And what I found, ironically enough, was we had so many new people in certain locations that they actually had less anxiety coming into the office because they were all new and they were excited to meet people. The more tenured staff who didn't know those people and had been there before, they had more anxiety. So what we did were actually in-office happy hours that we brought people into the office to not work, but to come in and have a drink and socialize to get them comfortable with the situation, kind of like when you walk your kid by the school and take them on the route when they start kindergarten so they get a feel for what it's like to go through the motions. We did that in the office, and it really helped break the ice for new people and old people alike.
Plus, they probably meet people with skills or aptitudes that they didn't even realize they had because you're not bumping into them at the coffee machine when you're working from home. So you've got to have a little social contact time to learn how these people can help you or what you can do for them.
There's no doubt about it. And we also did was we put color pictures of all the new hires on the office, on the walls. So when you walked in, you could the existing people could see them. So there wasn't the embarrassment to keep going back and saying, what's your name, what's your name, what's your name? And now our existing staff is much more ready to engage with the new hires. And then we also put banners around the office welcoming people back. We changed the look of the office a little bit to give people more excitement.
Reminds me a little bit of early in the pandemic, the medical staffs who were wearing masks, and they would sometimes post the picture of themselves on their with them. I'm trying to remember now if they would actually put a picture of themselves with the mask off on their shirt so you could see what the person looked like that was tending to you. They didn't normally have a picture of themselves on their person, but they would, so it would you have a little more humanity there that you were dealing with, you know?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I remember what you're talking about and having that in an office environment where, I mean, I can't tell you, John, just in the few days that we had people coming in for happy hours, seeing the amount of hugging that was going on and people who were so excited to see people, and some of them see each other socially, but they hadn't seen each other at work. And the excitement to engage with people and to finally meet people. And how many times can you hear, you're taller than I thought, you know, and I'm 6'5", right? And it's like, or you're shorter or whatever it is, but it showed the greatness of humanity that people were excited to be with one another.
It's nice to have a conversation like this today. Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network, the LaSalleNetwork.com. Nice to talk to you, Tom.
Stay healthy, John. Thanks for having me on.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch, and Philip Weiss joins us, president of Seyfarth at Work. Seyfarth.com's the website. That's Seyfarth. Philip, thanks for joining us again. You're on the air. How are you?
Great, and thanks for having me, John.
What's this a Supreme Court ruling or news, and how does that affect employers?
Yeah, it was sort of an eye-opener for a lot of business owners. The Supreme Court last week rejected the case brought by a florist. And the florist initially, the reason for the case in the first instance was the florist had refused to provide floral arrangements for a customer. And this customer's loved one, because they were going to engage in a same-sex wedding. And while the florist for many years, in fact, 9 years, had provided flowers to the individual, knowing that the person was gay, once the customer said, it's for my wedding, it's for a same-sex marriage, in a state where that was obviously legal, it was the state of Washington, LaFlora said, that's against my religious tenets. I cannot serve you in this instance. And a whole series of lawsuits resulted, John. The bottom line is last week, the Supreme Court, in the case everyone was waiting to see the outcome of, said, oh, we're not going to even entertain this case. The florist is, in fact, required de facto to serve a customer when that's the law of the state. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are now. And it's really a moment where business owners are saying to themselves, I have to take another look at when and I can versus cannot say no to a customer.
So the Supreme Court didn't pass judgment, but by rejecting it, it goes to the lower court's verdict, and they said that the business has to serve a gay couple flowers or, I guess, wedding cake or allow them to book the banquet at their place, that sort of thing, huh?
Yeah, exactly right. And what's significant is the Supreme Court ruling was 6-3. It didn't really fall clearly along ideological lines. It's the kind of case, unlike many, where people know the Supreme Court is going to make a statement either way. So by not taking the case, they're not simply refusing to opine or give their view. They're basically saying the majority here, the clear majority, says the lower court law is the correct law. And that's important because people expected this court, particularly today, to be deferring to business, to be giving business people discretion. But in this case, the goal of combating discrimination really trumps, so to speak, the goal of respecting the religious beliefs of the business owner, because those are both principles in the law. It's not as though one is connected to the law and the other one isn't. It really was a matter of what was the higher priority.
Do you think that it was a factor that the florist had previously been serving flowers to one of the members of this union and knew that person was gay? I wonder if that was a factor at all.
Well, that's a great question, John. And in fact, the Supreme Court of Washington, which is the most recent ruling we have, so to speak, to look at, did spend a fair amount of time talking about that pre-existing relationship. In fact, the couple had been dating for 9 years. The florist had been providing them flowers for 9 years. And the court made that connection kind of a highlight of their opinion. Other factors matter, too. For example, the florist acknowledged at the sort of the lower court level that she would not have objected to providing flowers to a wedding between two atheists, even though that's also a religious tenet she wholeheartedly rejects. So she's basically saying, I don't want to embrace one religious view, but implicitly I'll embrace another religious view that's in contradiction with my own set of values. So the court did look at those kind of factors, even if it didn't consider them directly in the final ruling.
Philip Weiss is on the line, president of SciFarth at Work. I wonder if the particulars of this case were different, if in fact another case could be ruled differently. Suppose you didn't have any relationship with these people previously or whatever. I wonder if there will be a different version of this down the road, Philip.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, the way people are looking at least as of now, John, is when the state says you can't discriminate based on a background, identity, or other characteristics, it could be sexual orientation, it could be political orientation in some states, the Supreme Court is probably going to back up that discrimination ban. We actually had a client, ran a bunch of dry cleaners, and he came to us because one of his managers was asking people who spoke Spanish as their first language to go to the back of the line because it was taking a little longer to serve those customers. Mm-hmm. And that was unequal treatment. And obviously that's a broader protection nationally, national origin or ancestry. But that was a big problem. So it's not simply saying no. It's also a matter of equal service at equal levels for different groups.
But you can say not serve a customer who comes into your restaurant if they don't have a shirt on or shoes on. I mean, there are circumstances where businesses can decline service to customers, right?
Absolutely. When we train on this, it's a really important point. We train on it, John. You know, take out the identity, sort of, you know, the race, religion, the things you're not going to sort of change about yourself in a moment because they make up who you are. Then bosses and customers have a lot more discretion. We call these a kind of the 5 or 6 C's, so to speak, words starting with C. And you're right, clothing, no shirts, no shoes, no service, is an existing right of managers to say, sorry, we can't serve you. Another C is actually criminal history. If you shoplifted from the store, they're not expected to invite you in to kind of paw through the jewelry section every other day. There's a number of areas. Another great one is if they feel you might create trouble or cause risk. So there's some really interesting cases out of California where members of a biker gang were asked not to wear their colors, meaning the bandana in the pocket that showed what gang they were affiliated with when they entered a bar, because the fear was if a different gang member comes in from another gang, a melee will ensue and trash the bar. The court in California said, absolutely the right of the bar owner to say this is related to protecting the establishment. Mm-hmm. It's not about your fundamental identity. It's about your gang affiliation.
Right.
We're going to restrict entry. So you're absolutely right.
We'll talk about this another day, but do you anticipate then this will also spill over into the political world? If I have a Trump hat or a Biden hat, they could refuse me service?
Well, you know, it already exists in some instances, and so it's a really important question. In Washington, D.C., if you are talking about or exhibiting your political orientation, that is not a good rationale, not acceptable rationale to be excluded from business. In many states, it hasn't yet achieved the status of being protected. So I suspect more protection along those lines, but we're just at the beginning.
Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work, SCYFARTH, SciFarth.com. Always interesting, Philip. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me, John.
You almost certainly have a device near you, a laptop, a desktop, a smartphone. In fact, you may be listening to us on one right now. Those things are big energy grabs, aren't they? If you're using your battery, you're always trying to think of ways to minimize the brain or the battery drain. And this is kind of interesting. Mike Casper is the founder of a company called Azumo. Azumotech.com is their website. That's spelled A-Z-U-M-O. It's a Chicago company. Mike, let's talk a little bit about your business. You're on the Wintrust Business Lunch. How are you?
Good. How are you doing this afternoon?
Pretty good. So tell me what your company does.
Yeah, so Azumo, as you had mentioned there, is a breakthrough display technology company that is disrupting a $130 billion display market. And our mission here is to enable LCD 2.0, which is really the future of displays, making them much more energy efficient, much more effective, and more safe on the eyes.
Make the displays more effective and even safe, you say. How do you do that?
Yeah, so it actually uses a new display technology called reflective LCD, not that different from what we're all used to seeing on our tablets and laptops and monitors, which has traditionally been backlit LCD. And so that technology uses lights to make the screen glow, and that's what we've been staring at, especially during COVID, day in and day out. And having that artificial light, blasting into our eyes every day is not that great for you. Using our technology and reflective LCD technology, it actually uses the ambient light around you. So whether you have lights on in your house or in your office, or even if you step outside, using the sunlight, actually reflects off the screen to enable you to see it, which is a much more natural way to look at these digital displays.
It would seem to me like if the light was bouncing off the screen, if I was using ambient light, it would just reflect back up. I would not see what is internal to the device. Is it using the ambient light to power it, or is it actually using the ambient light to illuminate it?
It's actually using it to illuminate it. So just like reading a book or reading a piece of paper, you're actually using ambient light to bounce off the surface, and that's how we see it. So this type of technology, it's a slight adaptation to LCDs, but it still uses the same digital backbone, and it's just much more natural as we as humans have essentially grown to look at displays and images.
So is this aftermarket stuff that I use on these products, or are you trying to get manufacturers to incorporate your technology?
So we're actually embedded inside the displays, inside these devices. Azumo is a value-added partner of Sharp, which is a very large electronics manufacturer, and we're their preferred front light component for these types of LCD screens. And they get embedded into anything from industrial to medical to consumer or even educational devices.
So have I seen then your technology at work? Give me an example. In an elevator, at a doctor's office, where have I seen your stuff?
So when we first launched, most of our products were embedded into more industrial and medical type devices that are more B2B applications. So you may have come across them, with sensors and other wearable medical devices. But what's really exciting for us is that we're entering the consumer market later this year, working on incorporating our technology into tablets for educational purposes.
That's still a B2B application, though, isn't it? You've got to get that done on the manufacturer's end, right?
Correct. We work within the LCD and the electronics supply chain to incorporate that inside the device design.
What's the 800-pound gorilla in the room? Who's it that you would really like to go after or partner with?
You know, there's so many different electronic brands out there. Obviously, Apple is one that we're all familiar with. But the great thing about the display industry is that, especially as information is continuing to get connected, we're having displays starting to get embedded in almost all of our devices.
Yeah.
So there's not necessarily one key customer we're looking for. We're just looking to help incorporate LCD 2.0 technology throughout a variety of applications.
We do seem to be addicted to information displays. Refrigerators have displays telling you, I don't know what they tell you, but it just seems like, you really don't have to have that. And yet we seem to be information overload people these days, don't we?
Yeah, and I think, that's an interesting trend, especially with 5G gigabit connectivity happening. That's going to be continue to be the future. And I think, we as consumers and users don't necessarily want to always have to pull out something out of our pocket or a smartphone or a tablet or a computer to get information at our fingertips. And I do think that you're going to start to see displays and information just to be more naturally incorporated into our day-to-day lives. Again, the key word there being natural and not making it feel like it's the digital experience.
Yeah, and one last thing, Mike, you referenced safety. You just think it's too much wear and tear on the eyes?
Yeah, I mean, I think through COVID, there's been studies showing that, you know, over two-thirds of us are showing a lot of eye fatigue, staring at our screens all day long. And so I think there's something there. We weren't built as humans to be staring at artificial light constantly throughout the day. And so I think we're still, the verdict's still out in what the long-term effects are here, but that's where we think reflective LCDs are a much more natural way to, and much more enjoyable way to look at this information.
And how many, you guys are based in Chicago. Do you manufacture in Chicago? How many employees do you have?
Yes, we have 30 employees here. We use manufacturing of our key technology here in the Midwest, some Chicago-based vendors as well. And a lot of our products get incorporated into the electronics globally. So we're shipping a lot to Asia and also have customers and suppliers there as well.
Hmm. Azumo, azumotech.com is the website. Find out more. Mike Casper is the founder. Really interesting, Mike. Well, I'm glad I know a little bit about this. It's fascinating. I wish you nothing but success.
Great. Thank you very much.
It's 12:43. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. We've got more business news now with Steve Grzanich.
Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago insurance startup ClearCover is giving its employees the option of working four-day weeks during July and August. The employees reported in surveys that the toll of the pandemic and complexities of remote work were causing increased stress and the need for more mental health support. Chicago Inno reports the company's CEO instituted the four-day weeks for the summer as a way to ease stress and prevent worker burnout. ClearCover's platform uses artificial intelligence to make custom car insurance coverage recommendations to customers. It has about 300 employees. Chicago-based Grubhub is implementing new features designed to keep prices low and make up for late deliveries. As part of the lowest price Grubhub guarantee, if a customer finds a better price for a Grubhub order on another third-party delivery service, Grubhub will make up the difference with Grubhub perks. The other feature allows customers to earn Grubhub perks on their next order if their current order arrives late. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minutes.
We've got the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, so Johnny, have you wasted any food today?
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. One estimate says about 40% of food in the United States goes to the dump.
Globally, it attributes to about 8% of greenhouse gas emissions. So if food waste were a country, it would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases after the U.S. and China.
Oh, if only there was an app that would help cut down on food waste by offering us a prize. Well, there is, says Claire Oliverson, head of marketing for Too Good To Go. Just download the app.
We have over 60 restaurants actually already on board in the Chicago area. And, you know, whether you're into sushi or ice cream or, you know, produce, what have you.
And here's the hook. You can buy food for a third of the regular price, and you can feel better about the planet, too. This is Chicago, so let's use pizza as an example. You see a pizza place on the app, and then...
through the app, you reserve a surprise bag, and that is what you pay a third of the price for. So let's say you're getting three pizza slices. You know, that's typically $15. You'd pay $5 in the app. And then you go and you pick up that surprise bag from that local partner.
Too Good To Go officially launches tomorrow in Chicago, but the app is live now and you can check it out for yourself. It started where?
In Denmark in 2016.
And Chicago's the 9th U.S. city where the app is live. Wait a minute. 9th? Chicago's arguably the greatest food city in the country, and you're just now coming here?
It's a great question, actually. Chicago is an amazing food city. It's one of the most influential cities in the U.S., and we really wanted to make sure we were doing it right from day one.
Good answer, huh? Day one tomorrow is tomorrow for Too Good To Go. That's the name of the app. At the Chicago Board of Trade, we have a mixed bag with wheat down 4 cents. Soybeans are trading about 6 cents higher. Beans, or corn that is now up about a nickel. Today's Farm to Your Belly feature, it is National French Fry Day, and if you haven't found free French fries someplace, you're not trying very hard. National Beans and Franks Day. Not sure anybody's giving out any free beans and franks. It's also National Cow Appreciation Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Not because it's the most important story of the day, but because I don't want us to do this segment and not get to it, I'm going to start it with Kraft macaroni and cheese. ice cream. Amy Guth, for crying out loud, that's going to happen, huh?
Yeah, that's a thing. That's not a sentence I thought I would ever say. But yes, Kraft mac and cheese ice cream is a thing. So Chicago-based Kraft Heinz has partnered with Van Leeuwen Ice Cream. If you're familiar with them, they don't have stores in the Chicago area, as far as I am aware. But they are a company that makes some really interesting and creative flavors. They also usually make a dairy-free version of most of their flavors. But you can order online. So starting Wednesday, people will be able to order this. It's about $12 a pint. It's going to be a limited edition thing through the summer. A couple of food writers have tried it and have written some reviews about how it tastes. Those reviews have been mixed, as I'm sure you can imagine. One kind of described it like, well, it's sort of like cold mac and cheese, but not. But it's a savory ice cream that is supposed to mimic that flavor of the blue box stuff.
Yeah. Actually, listen to this. Ad Age reporter Jessica Wall says it has a hint of cheese flavor, but it's not overpowering. It would work well on top of a warm slice of apple pie because people like cheese on their pie. So a cheesy ice cream might, I don't know, maybe I'll warm to this, Amy.
Yeah, I can see it. Some other people have suggested some food pairings for it, too, that, you know, we'll see what happens. I think it'll be interesting to see what sales look like over the summer. So while it won't be available in a shop here, you can get it online. They do ship nationwide from Van Leeuwen. So it'll be interesting to see what those sales look like and how people take to that kind of ice cream.
Kraft mac and cheese ice cream. Consumer prices are going up. We told you so.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that has been the case for sure. And so specifically looking at numbers around that, prices for consumer goods jumped by in June by the most for the most in 13 years. So that's about rebound. That's about that's also about, you know, supply shortages that we've been seeing. Specifically, 5.4% up over the past year, and that's the sharpest 12-month inflation spike since August of 2008. If you take volatile oil and gas prices out of that, you're left with what's kind of referred to as the core inflation. That core inflation rose 4.5% in the past year, which that number is the biggest increase since November of 1991. So it certainly, I think, is prompting some questions about whether or not the Feds are going to change that low interest rate and act a little bit early to pull back on that ultra low rate. They've said they would not do that. A lot of officials have said that this kind of inflation is to be expected with any kind of rebound. It's going to be very temporary. But I think a lot of eyes will be on that interest rate number to see what the Fed does.
That kind of rebound, meaning not a traditional inflationary cycle, but maybe something that's predicated on the Suez Canal, the pandemic, the chip shortage,
right?
All of those things that will resolve themselves, right?
Exactly. Right. So they're saying this is it's normal to see a little bit of a surge forward anytime there's any kind of rebound, but especially this one, just given how many events all kind of swirl together to create all the issues.
What's your Boeing news today?
Yeah, so Boeing, the 787 Dreamliner is back in the news. Some issues started with it back in August. There were some manufacturing concerns, some flags that were raised, and this is, you know, kind of another black mark on Boeing. But what they did earlier today is they disclosed there's a new issue with the 787 Dreamliner. It is, so far, it is pertaining to jets that have not yet been delivered. It's the way that the fuselage is joined together. It's not meeting the standards, but it's also reopening some questions about that verification process, which has kind of been at the heart of things for Boeing for a while, since that 737 MAX grounding that lasted, you know, about 14, 15 months. Ever since then, there has been questions about, you know, it was kind of an honor system between Boeing and the FAA. And so that's been kind of looked at and examined very deeply. Here's more questions about that verification system, making sure that those precise standards are upheld. So Boeing plans to repair the planes that have not yet been delivered prior to their delivery. It says right now that there's no threat to any of the 787 Dreamliners that are currently operating, but they are going to look at data after they fix the ones that have not yet been delivered and see if any other issues, any adjustments need to be made to the planes that are already in service.
Let's talk about flying with or without a mask. What's the rule? Where's it trending?
Yeah, so as of right now, people still do have to wear a mask. That's federally mandated on aircraft and in airports, and that's going to be the case till September 14th when that ruling expires. But recently, United CEO Scott Kirby, he was on Meet the Press on Sunday, and he was kind of reading some tea leaves and talking about what travel's looking like right now, and he was really speaking to this huge rebound of leisure travel in the summer. But he predicted a great deal of rebound in business travel by fall. That has not been a universal message from all airlines and airline kind of trade groups, but that was his message. But he also said he really hoped that federal rule would not be renewed after September 14th. He hoped that he saw people flying maskless or optional maskless. He said, fingers crossed, anyway, that would not be renewed and not go on any longer. He was very optimistic. He was really kind of looking at travel into Europe. He said that's going to rebound just as soon as restrictions are lifted. He, talked about how they were able to hire back a lot of their staff to meet demand, but lamented there were still some TSA hiring gaps, as well as some businesses that are in airports and other airport workers. But he was overall very, very optimistic about the rebound in travel.
This is the United chief you're talking about, right?
That's right. Scott Kirby. He's the CEO of United.
We are flying to Europe this fall, and it'll be in October. So September 14th looks pretty good to me. I hope I would be comfortable on an 8-hour flight without a mask on. I would be uncomfortable with it on, but I might be uncomfortable with it off for 8 hours because I'd feel especially exposed over that period of time. I don't know. But then again, Amy, we got used to it in restaurants, so maybe everything will come in small steps, and by that time it'll feel okay.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the name of the game with a lot of things, with movie theaters, restaurants, air travel.
Yeah.
Even once mask mandates are lifted, I think there's a matter of consumer comfort and letting people kind of do what they're comfortable with.
But you also alluded to he's hoping it doesn't get renewed. So September 14th, that goalpost could move, couldn't it?
It could move. I don't know if that's likely, but it certainly could if, say, new variants sparked more outbreaks, something like that. I think it's really a matter of vaccination rates continuing to go up and case rates continuing to go down.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.